Well, I think we'll get started if we can get our troops corralled. Thank you very much for joining us on this, thankfully it's not quite as rainy a morning as we've had the last few days. My name is Carola Weil, and I'm a grants program officer in our grant program here at the U.S. Institute of Peace, and it gives me great pleasure to welcome all of you here for a very special occasion. This is really, in some ways, a book launch. It is an introduction to new innovations in education, in training, in thinking about nonviolent conflict and nonviolent approaches to conflict in new and different ways. And I'm very pleased to have with me two groups that have really been pioneers in this area. On my right, I'm very pleased to welcome the founding chair and president of the International Center on Nonviolent Conflict, ICNC, Peter Ackerman, and his frequent collaborator and friend and colleague and longtime supporter of many of these educational efforts, Peter York, to his Steve York, to his right. On my left, I'm very pleased to present to you the team that is CANVAS, the center, the Center for Applied Nonviolent Action and Strategies, and they have come the furthest from Belgrade, Serbia. And so we're particularly pleased to have these three gentlemen with us today. He is also sitting here in the front row. And finally, at the very end, but certainly not last and not least by any means, James O'Brien, currently of the Albright Group, who served as special presidential envoy for the Balkans during the Bosnian crisis, and will be able to share with us some of his reflections on how the strategies that we will talk about in the next hour or so play out in the real world of politics and diplomacy. I don't want to go into great detail on introducing our speakers. There are bios available outside. We also have much literature and information available for you, but let me just briefly say, why are we putting together this event today? There are really three reasons. For one, through the grants, education, and training programs of the Institute, USIP has sought to foster an understanding of nonviolent approaches to conflict management virtually since the Institute's conception and founding. We have supported studies of the role of nonviolent sanctions and peace-building strategies through the development of textbooks, documentary films, and curricula, as well as research and analysis of cases of successful struggles for peace, whether in Thailand and Burma, the Middle East, even Haiti, the Balkans, or the Velvet Revolutions of Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union. In that regard, we've also had a very long-standing and quite successful collaboration with ICNC over the years, and we're very pleased to add this joint effort to the occasion. Here, I would also like to extend a special thank you to all those people who have helped us behind the scenes, and particularly Jack Duval, who is sitting in the audience, and without whom we really wouldn't have been able to put together all of this work. The staff of ICNC, our staff here at the Institute, as well as friends of both the Institute and the Center, Albert Zavalos, among others. This truly has been a team effort to bring all of this together. The other reason for bringing us together today is that we have a brand new cookbook or a manual hot off the press, and I hope if you haven't had a chance to pick it up yet that you will. There also is, for those of you who don't have the time to read an entire book, although I can assure you it has lots and lots of pictures. So for those weary of reading lots of Washington wonkish texts, there's plenty of imagery for you to go with. But we do have a one-pager that describes the new manual, which has been produced by Canvas with the support of USIP, and we're very pleased to be able to present it here for the very first time in public on either side of the Atlantic, I might add. This has not been rolled out in Europe, has not been seen anywhere else, so this is really your first peek at this work. I also would like to bring to your attention, and I hope we'll hear a little bit more about this, the latest innovation and initiative in the line of work that ICNC has done. As many of you know, they are known not only for their scholarship, among others, this book, which I've used in teaching. I'm sure many of you have also seen it, as well as really the groundbreaking and award-winning videos, A Force More Powerful and Bringing Down a Dictator. These films have not only inspired activists, but have also served a tremendous educational function in schools and universities. Most recently, though, we have added new technologies to the efforts of teaching about nonviolent struggle and also for the training of activists. And here we have a brand new interactive video game, which is still under development, I think, or it's...
It will never stop being developed.
It will never stop being developed, and Steve will surely tell us a bit more about this, but this is really what I see as some of the new frontiers in... pedagogy and training on the topics of nonviolent struggle. So without further ado, let me turn over the podium, table, panel. You may sit here or there and, to Peter Ackerman. Thank you.
Good morning. I mean, first, let me ask, how many are students from the American School here today?
American University.
I'm sorry. My children went to the American School. I'm delighted to have you here, and I hope you'll find the session useful. The fact is ICNC wouldn't exist without Dick Solomon and the U.S. Institute of Peace, because it was at their behest that we received a grant to make a proposal to WETA to do our first movie, A Force More Powerful, and that relationship, the impetus of that relationship and what it's created since is something I hope the USIP should be very, very proud of. And we're very grateful for it. I'd like to kick off the discussion today by just offering a definition of people power so we can have a consistent use of the term in these discussions. If anybody else wants to define it differently, that's fine, but at least we'll get people oriented to the subject and some other comments I'll make about it. People power is generally is a term coined in the Philippines during the Marcos conflict that basically is vernacular for something called nonviolent conflict. A nonviolent conflict is what people do when they're living under some form of oppression but have no viable military option in which to deal with that oppression. And so what they do instead is to use various civilian-based tactics, strikes, boycotts, mass protests, other forms of civil disobedience, to create a level of civic disruption that makes it impossible for an authoritarian or those who are the source of the oppression to continue with the status quo. And if this kind of conflict persists, what it tends to also do is eat away at what we would call the pillars of support that undermine the authoritarian's ability to stay in power or to basically hold power at the level they do hold it. So these pillars might be religious institutions, they might be bureaucratic institutions, they might be economic or business institutions, and also, and very frequently, they are the military and security services, because those loyalties are in no circumstance, and I'll get back to this point several times, the loyalties in the security services, no matter how difficult and repressive regime are, they're not all equal. And there's always opportunities to exploit differentials in those loyalties, and that's what civic-based resistance or nonviolent conflict or people power is designed to do. As a matter of fact, if you really reflect on what happened in the Philippines, the reason why Marcos became vulnerable is because the military split. Now, these tactics that I've described really are nothing of themselves unless they are sequenced into a strategy that furthers the agreed upon goals of the movement. And so a successful strategy is built on the understanding of the vulnerabilities of an adversary, as well as the capabilities and staying power of the nonviolent opposition. So Tiananmen, at one level, was a very successful tactic, but it was empty as a strategy because nothing came afterwards. And it's important to keep that distinction between tactics and strategy as we continue the discussion. I think I've been active in this subject now for 30 years, since back to my Fletcher School days when I did the doctoral dissertation on the topic. And I think that there tends to be consistent misunderstandings about what the subject is. So I'd like to sort of talk for a minute about what nonviolent conflict isn't. One thing, and this might be most useful for my friends at the American School, I mean at the American University. Pardon me again. First of all, nonviolent conflict is different from nonviolence, which is an ethical proposition that's a very admirable one. It's equivalent usually to pacifism, and it's something that people adopt individually and perfectly reasonable, but it's not what changes the political equation and the nature of repression that people deal with. One way to get at this point is to make the simple comment that in the history since the 20th century of nonviolent conflict, the overwhelming percentage of people who have led those conflicts, if they had had a military option that was viable, they would have used it. In other words, they had no ethical inhibition about using violence. They just came for a variety of reasons to the notion that this type of conflict was going to be the one that would be the most effective for what they were trying to achieve. Also, nonviolent conflict is not the same thing as conflict prevention or conflict resolution or peacemaking. What we're talking about is a phenomenon that occurs when people can't prevent a conflict and when people can't resolve a conflict. It's what happens in the in-between, with where they choose to select certain tactics that they think will maximize their chances of achieving their goals. A more recent, confusion comes from the notion, particularly out of the colored revolutions, that nonviolent conflict is sort of the same as a coup or regime change. And there's a couple of problems with this in terms of the actual data. One is that, and I think that a lot of people come to this conclusion because they look at the Iraq situation, which was a toppling, an external military toppling for democratic purposes, and they assume that the colored revolutions was just an extension of that. But the fact is that no nonviolent resistance movement really succeeds unless it's driven indigenously. It can't be imposed from the outside. There's things you can do to be helpful, like what ICNC tries to do, which is exchange information about the nature of nonviolent conflict. But ultimately, unless the movement is indigenously driven, it's not going to succeed. Out of frustration over the coverage of the Rose Revolution and the Orange Revolution, Saakashvili and Yushchenko got together in a little ski resort in Tisovets and issued the beginning of January 2005, something called the Carpathian Declaration, which said anybody who believes that these movements were externally driven is just plain wrong. They were driven from the inside out. Also, when we talk about regime change, I think we have to be very careful with our terminology, is that regime change conjures up in today's vernacular this concept of a toppling. But regimes do change under pressure. Nonviolent conflict changes regimes under pressure, but they change in really one of three ways. One is, and this is the most rare, one is the people at the top having experienced the pressure of these various tactics say, well, maybe you have a point, and I come to your way of thinking, and they're converted in some way. Very rare, hard to even name a case when that does occur. I'm sorry? Oh, I thought so. I'm sorry? Nepal, okay, great, thank you. And but the more frequent way nonviolent resistance ends in a conflict is there's some form of accommodation. The authoritarian or the oppressor feels some kind of pressure. He doesn't feel that he can use maximum repression, or he doesn't have the capability to, and they come to some kind of modus vivendi. An example of that would be in the Gdansk shipyard strikes, where they absolutely had to have the Polish workers back. They basically conceded to a free trade union for the first time, which created a wedge, which created additional activity and ultimately led to the fall of communism 7 years later. But that was an accommodation. And finally, what can happen is that in the process of this pressure being created, the authoritarian or the people in power who are creating the oppression, I use this term generally, and I'll go into to what the nature of oppression could be and what it subsumes in a minute, but when that occurs, as the pressure is created, these pillars of support can so disintegrate, can so be undermined, that the authoritarian no longer can stay in power and he's forced to leave. You know, that would be the case of what happened in Serbia, certainly in Chile, and to a degree, certainly in South Africa, because both of basically was forced out of power. And this gets to this point I was about to make, is that there's not, that when we think of regime change as equivalent to nonviolent conflict, we forget that nonviolent conflict doesn't only work or is not only involved with bringing down a dictator. It could be involved in issues of gender equity, environmental degradation, anti-corruption movements, backsliding democracy, where, you know, there's actually a vote and then the people who basically come into power take away powers. We have this game that was that Carol mentioned that were played, and we have 10 stock scenarios, and only one of them is how to bring down a dictator or how to play the game about a dictator. There are many, many other ways that nonviolent conflict is used as a form of pressure to create results. As a matter of fact, I think nonviolent conflict is best understood when it's thought of as a contest. And this is not a remarkably new idea. As a matter of fact, the man who forwarded my first book, Tom Schelling, basically wrote the following 45 years ago. And if you remember, Tom Schelling just won the Nobel Prize for his work on game theory and the nuclear weapon. But this is what... What's that?
Your time will come.
Who knows? We'll give it to you instead, Dick. Okay. This is what he said 45 years ago. Listen carefully, because this is important. He said, "The tyrant and his subjects are in somewhat symmetrical positions. They can deny him most of what he wants. They can, that is, if they have the disciplined organization to refuse collaboration. And he can deny them just about everything they want. He can deny it by using the force at his command. They can deny him the satisfaction of ruling a disciplined country. He can deny them the satisfaction of ruling themselves. It is a bargaining situation in which either side, if adequately disciplined and organized, could deny most of what the other wants, and it remains to see who wins." So when people power is understood as a contest with an indeterminate outcome, other myths start to melt away as well. And here are two that I have 1 minute left. Okay. I have to, I'll just stop here and then I'll make some comments later, just after I make the last point here. The first myth is that it only works in certain cultural settings, and this is what you're starting to hear with respect to the colored revolutions, which basically are Eastern European oriented, and they're in a particular finite period of time since the beginning of this century. But the fact is, if you look at our movies and the context, they're highly diverse in terms of where people power movements have occurred and where nonviolent conflict has been waged. So in our first movie, we have the Indian Independence Movement in 1930. We have the National Lunch Counter Boycotts. We have the Anti-Apartheid Movement. We have the Danish Resistance to the Nazis. We have the Polish Solidarity Movement, the Anti-Pinochet Movement. And when you really look at the movements today, when people, one of the things that, reasons why I think USIP should be so, I think, lauded for what they did for us, is that these movies, when they've been seen, they've now been seen in 60 countries. When people look at these movements, they basically say, well, we'd like to do what they did. And the interesting part is, listen to where they come from. Because they don't see cultural specificity as an obstacle. They come from Cuba, Belarus, Iran, China, Zimbabwe, just to name a few. And the other thing that I think I'd like to sort of debunk for a second, then I'll sit down, is that people power, the notion that people power only works in places with some political space. There has to be some political space. And that's generally, then the comment you generally hear is that they only work in semi-authoritarian environments and not in super repressive regimes. Now, one of the things you have to do if you're being realistic, you have to also concede that nonviolent conflict doesn't always work. It fails in many places. It's failing in Burma. And you can all, you know, it's failing in Zimbabwe. And it has yet to work in Belarus. But once you concede that there has been places of failure, you also have to concede that there's been places where it's been extraordinarily successful in very, very tough environments. When Lech Walesa saw our movie in Poland, he said, you know, your movie's no good because you forgot to mention that we got the free trade union when 250,000 Soviet troops were on our soil. Or who could, you know, I think we forget how difficult it was for blacks in South Africa. And we certainly also tend to forget a little bit how difficult Pinochet was in the first 5 years of his rule. Those were regimes that I would hardly call as considered to be semi-authoritarian. And the fact and the basis of our work is that authoritarians are vulnerable because they thrive on tranquility. They need the obedience of populations. Civic disruption of any kind, particularly if it persists, basically delegitimizes those at the top, and the repression that they create in response brings with it very, very significant risks. As a matter of fact, one of the things about an authoritarian, particularly the worst of them, is that they have to be 100% successful with a repression, because if they're not, then their credibility is shot. And let me just stop by just giving you a little quote from a fellow named M. Kaseli Jack, who was a 26-year-old organizer from Port Elizabeth, South Africa. He's the focus of our story in A Force More Powerful in South Africa. After the declaration of the first state of emergency, equivalent to what then was the Polish martial law that happened around the same time, it was the first time that was instituted. It was a nonviolent tactic that instituted the state of emergency. It was the first time it happened since 1962. Kusta was quickly arrested, and here was his analysis at the time of what he was facing. He said, if they declared a state of emergency, they, that means the white government, was panicking. They could feel us coming. It means that extraordinary measures were necessary to keep apartheid alive, and we were there to give it the push, the push, the push. So what did M. Kaseli Jack learn in the heat of battle? He learned that they had fired their best shot and they could deal with it. And once you're in a position like that and you know that you're still standing, you always have the ability in the nonviolent resistance movement to use the forces of what civilians do every day to disrupt an authoritarian regime and to create strategic opportunities. So I'll stop here, and I thank you for listening.
I apologize that we have to be a bit draconian about time, but as you see, we have a table full of talents, and we want to give due to everyone that is here. But we will have ample opportunity during the question and answer period to come back to some of these points. Let me turn over the podium to Steve.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to be short to compensate for Peter's overage a little bit, but I always intended to be short because of all of those who are sitting at this table, I feel I'm least qualified to speak to you. We have here people who've either studied this for 30 years or been engaged in nonviolent struggle as practitioners. And at best, I'm an observer of a fairly superficial kind in that I'm just a filmmaker or a television producer. But I wanted to make that very, very clear. I met Sergej Popovich, to Karola's left, about 10 days after Milosevic stepped down. I'd been trying to get into Serbia earlier than that because we thought there was a film to make there about what was going on. But after the NATO bombing in the spring of 99, American passport holders had a hard time getting a visa, and I hadn't been able to get in. I knew about Serge from other people, and we might have been in email or telephone contact. I think we were. I'll never forget walking through Republic Square in downtown Belgrade and along the shopping district, which is closed to traffic, an area called Plato, for those of you who know Belgrade. And I was still on a different time zone and jet lagged in other ways. And Serge is walking next to me, speaking as he's capable of doing at about 80 miles an hour, and every 30 seconds handing me another piece of paper that I have to read. You know, this is an excerpt from a training manual, and this is, and I thought, I got my hands on something here. There's no way you can make a film and even get a third of this in. Somehow or other, we managed to make the film, and we've come an enormous distance, as Peter's mentioned. And I wanted to talk about that distance and what has happened in the way ordinary people, not scholars, not policymakers, but ordinary people, in which I include myself as a journalist, what has happened, especially in the last 4 or 5 years. Because I think I'm going to borrow from another one of my friends from Serbia, who's sitting here in the front row, Ivan Maravich, last night, in an odd moment, we had dinner, and in an odd moment said, you know, one of the problems with nonviolent struggles, actual cases where they've occurred, is that the academic community tends to look at these things as if they were accidents. It's something that just happened. It's not something that somebody sat down quietly and planned and made it happen. It tends to be regarded by historians and academics as something that happened almost spontaneously. Now, some things have happened spontaneously, and certain episodes and moments within nonviolent conflicts have been spontaneous. But for the most part, the ones that I've looked at, anyway, all of the ones that Peter just mentioned in India, South Africa, Poland, Chile, were the result of somebody, a group of people, in fact, planning, deciding that this is what they were going to do and figuring out how to do it. And that indicates that this is something that can be done consciously and that it is done consciously. I think this is an absolutely key point. The fact is, for many, many years, probably 50 or 60 or 70 years, no one, except for a handful of people, a very small handful, I include Peter in this handful, was, to use a popular phrase, no one was connecting the dots. No one thought much about studying the Indian independence movement and what Gandhi did, and the American Civil Rights Movement, and the Polish Solidarity Movement, and the Chilean Democracy Movement, and the Philippines People Power Revolution of 86, that somehow that these things represented a collection of information, of case studies, of data that had anything in common other than specific to themselves. When people started to connect the dots, and I think this began to occur in a popular level, much more beginning with what happened in Serbia in 2000, except it didn't happen in 2000. It happened over a period of years culminating in 2000. I want to make that point very clear. But then 3 years later in Georgia, we had the Rose Revolution. And exactly a year after that, we have what's been called the Orange Revolution in Ukraine. And maybe you can include Kyrgyzstan or others. But these three represent a progression that suddenly drew a lot of attention to the notion that these kinds of events, these so-called revolutions, maybe have something in common. And that's where I'm going to stop. I offer a slightly contrarian view. I can't tell you how many studies, magazine articles, journal articles, and speeches have been written comparing particularly Serbia, Georgia, and Ukraine. And most of the purpose of these articles and analyses and studies and books has been to look for common points, to somehow or other extract from these three experiences a formula. Now, there are common points, and I can tick them off quickly. All three revolved around an election of a president, and fraud in that election, and the use of outrage at that fraud as a mechanism to mobilize people. They all involved, to some degree or another, a youth resistance movement along the lines of Otpor, which was the kind of model from Serbia. I could go on, but I think, frankly, and this is my contrarian view, and this has to do with my bias as a filmmaker who tells very particular stories rather than dealing in abstractions or theoreticals. It's about particularity. And if you look at these stories very, very closely, you discover there are as many differences as there are points in common. And in many ways, there's more to learn from the differences than there is from the points that they have in common. And I encourage you to do that. I'm going to stop, having made that point, and try to leave the maximum amount of time for those who've actually engaged in these kinds of struggles. But of course, I'll be around for questions afterward if you have any. Thanks.
Now let me turn over to our authors, activists, leaders, and Serja, take the lead.
Thank you, Steve. First of all, I would like to say how happy I am to be here. I think, if I'm not wrong, my friend Daniel will correct me, for the fourth time in my life, sitting in the United States Institute of Peace, which was a very important institution, together with some individuals also present here, like my friend Jim O'Brien here at the end of the table, who were among those to persuade American administration that pressure, force, and military power is not the way to remove Milosevic. And as well as Dan, we're now talking about how people power, what Peter just said, is a force more powerful in order to change the societies. First of all, I need to jump on something which my friend Steve York just said. We are all very much into trying to prove that the knowledge transfer from one group to another is possible. It is, of course, completely impossible to export nonviolent revolution. Why? It is very easy to export violent revolution. You need, 300-400 strong men with guns? You jump into the presidential palace, take over the government, main airport, main radio station, main TV station, and boom, you have the Che Guevara move from one country to another. But there is no way you can import 2 million people on a Maidan square in Ukraine from Serbia. You cannot do that. But the experience of my organization, Canvas, as well as the experience of my friends here, is that people can learn. A few months ago, and I have a witness here, my friend Jack DeWald, the very strange-looking people approached us in an NGO conference in Nantes, and they were looking like they were coming from exotic islands. And they came to me and say, "We know you from the movie." And I say, "Very nice, okay, but who are you?" Actually, they were people coming from Maldives Island, where Steve York's movie, Bringing Down the Dictator, is illegally dubbed to their own language, distributed all over the population, out of which almost 20% has already been arrested for opposing the government. Less than a month ago, my friend Slobodan Djinovic here was meeting the group from this island. There is a tremendous growing interest on this knowledge, and our book here is an attempt to help spreading this knowledge. Ivan, please. I will now shortly jump to what you have in your hands, and we can provide you more copies. This book is an attempt to get closer to those who are real practitioners of strategic nonviolent struggle. There is a huge, tremendous theoretical knowledge on one side, and there are people who are practicing this in field. And my organization is very much dedicated into cooperating with those, like United States Institute for Peace or International Center on Nonviolent Conflict, who are dealing with tools how to transfer this knowledge. And we see this book as one of the tools, like you can see in front of Carola here. You have the movies and the game and the books. And we like to make this knowledge transfer process easily. The book is completely developed, well, we say the user-friendly format. Actually, if you open it, it looks like the piece of paper you get when you buy your DVD. It has, like, before you start, starting out, and running the nonviolent campaign. It's all about the question how to deal with these things. Well, the topics covered in the book include the theory of political power, fundamentals of strategic and detailed tactical planning, all in the forms of the exercise. And if you go through the book, you will see the things like in this four dummies stuff, like always do that, never do that. And our idea was to structure the book that it's really about the manual. So what we try to tell people is there is no huge story about this, and everybody can do this. We did it in Serbia, people did it in Georgia. Even before us, people were doing it in India, in Poland, in Chile, in Philippines. It can be done. The skills you bring into the conflict are more important than the conditions you find there. And I will refer to what Peter says. We are deeply sure that political space is not given to pro-democratic movements. Political space is to be conquered by them. Well, this book is a product of our interaction with 21 groups from 23 countries. And after the Serbian revolution in 2000, many groups from activists, NGOs, political parties, from people coming from conflicts to university institutions like some universities and states were interested in speaking about these issues. And I'm very glad to say that we tried to put a part of this experience into the user-friendly format. And every single time you meet a person from Colombia to Zimbabwe, Georgia, Ukraine, Iran, or West Papua, you learn something. And you learn about their conflicts and their efforts and their attempts. And we try to put a little bit of this experience into this book. Then the target audiences, of course. Our idea was, together with USIP, who granted us with a support for this book, is to develop a multi-profile thing. So you have the one target audience, which is typical for what Canvas is doing. These are people coming from conflicts, the group who want the knowledge transfer. And what we do with them are workshops. Then the activists coming from, let's say, democratic countries, but are particularly interested into the issue. We help the people from Colombia build up their own strategy against FARC, the terroristic organization controlling the part of the country. We are now negotiating about helping the people from Nigeria who are opposing the big companies environmentally destroying the Niger Delta. So it is not only about changing the regimes. It is about bringing the change to the society with a strategic nonviolent struggle. And of course, here are the international NGOs and educational institutions, all those who are interested in spreading this knowledge and learning more. And of course, format, you see, the book, it is very good for some of these audiences. Somewhere you cannot bring the book. If you have the book like this, you may be stopped on the border. And therefore, our idea was to make this knowledge available to the people. So it's downloadable from free from www.canvasopedia.org. And also there is a mini CD, very easy to put in your pocket and bring with you wherever you go. So our idea was to reach these audiences, but also to make a format available for them. Ewan, please. Well, three parts of the book. Before you start, teaches you something about the theory. And then starting out, these basic skills, like how do you plan things, how do you build strategy, and how do you craft your message. And then the last part you will probably find most interesting in the book is the part about how do you run the movement? How do you deal with the time planning? How do you recruit, train, and act with your activists? How do you deal with the fear? How do you work under the repression? Now, before I finish and leave the floor to my colleague here, Andriy Milivojevic, I would like to say another thing. I would like to say how grateful I am to see the people here who are supporting this idea in the Serbia from the very beginning, and express my hope that we will work together in future in providing the better tools and better equipment to help those who are struggling for democracy in their countries. Thank you.
So, Serge kind of gave us an overview as to what we did and why we did it, and the guy from Berkeley gets to tell you how we did it. I'll briefly outline the four big choices that we had to make in writing the book. And I think they deal with some of the more foundational issues, namely what are the necessary prerequisites for success, how do we approach the issue of political power, individual and collective decision making, and so-called smart practices. And I'll discuss those in turn.
Stand by the microphone.
I'm sorry, I apologize. Yeah, okay. If it hasn't been lost already. If any existed to begin with. Necessary prerequisites for success. Dr. Ackerman mentioned this briefly, but one of the big debates that we had to kind of discuss in deciding what to write had to do with whether skills or conditions are preponderantly important in determining the outcome of a strategic nonviolent struggle. There's a ton of literature on this, and what we tried to do in the book is essentially say, since the book is intended for those who are just starting out, in the short run, new movements tend to have greater control over skill building as opposed to controlling outside conditions. So we focus on skills as opposed to conditions. But there's another point and another reason why we focus on skills more than outside conditions, and that's even if the conditions are fantastic, after the nonviolent movement has kind of done its big task, skills are necessary to kind of safeguard what's been achieved, and not only to safeguard, but also to maintain the gains. So on a more broad point in terms of skills and conditions, we represent, you know, the 50 crucial points as exclusively necessary as opposed to sufficient. What I mean by necessary as opposed to sufficient is a sufficient condition guarantees you an outcome. So we never write in the book, we're very explicit, if you do these things, you will succeed. To the contrary, we say, you know, if you don't understand the basics, experience shows that it's highly unlikely that you will succeed. And even if you do succeed, it's even unlikelier that the gains that you have made will be kind of perpetuated. So moving on to political power, unlike necessary and sufficient conditions, or like necessary and sufficient conditions, there's an even broader literature on political power. And we simply had to make some decisions about how do we present people who are just coming into strategic nonviolent struggle, what do? How do they understand? How do they conceptualize political power? Now, rather than tackling the issue of political power first, what we said is that essentially the choice that has to be made is reliance or rejection of violence. Now, once you've steadfastly rejected violence, there's a very easy, convenient, effective theoretical approach to understanding power in society that you can apply. But first, you kind of have to you absolutely must reject violence. The theoretical framework I'm referring to is Gene Sharp's theory of power. And his perhaps his most famous sentence appears on page 17, 1973 edition. Obedience is the heart of political power. Dr. Ackerman mentioned this before. If you think about this statement, it means there's essentially a bargain involved. And the bargain is quite simple. If enough people withdraw consent, the decision makers cannot implement policies. This doesn't only hold for political decision makers, it holds true for decision makers in other settings. But the bargaining aspect in power relations is crucial, and especially when you're starting out, we thought that it would be very important to highlight this element. However, this constrains somewhat the discussion that follows. Specifically, if you focus on bargaining, it's much easier to discuss institutional change as opposed to systemic structures. So understanding, you know, how governments change, you know, how you can decrease corruption is a lot easier within the bargaining framework than trying to, say, change a systemic structure like patriarchy. Now, it's important to underline that strategic nonviolence can be and has been successfully applied to changing structures such as patriarchy or gender inequality. However, to do that, you need a little bit more than just, you know, Gene Sharp's framework, and you need a little bit more than 50 crucial points. So that's for volume two. Next, so if there's a lot written on political power, there's even more written on individual and collective decision making. I should say that although there is a little bit of jargon on the slides, none of it appears in the book at all. In fact, I think the only jargony terms that we use is supply and demand, which are somewhat intuitive, so I don't think that that discounts us. The two important things about supply and demand of nonviolent action that we mentioned are that perceived alternatives affect its demand, while high costs of organization decrease the supply. I want to reflect very briefly on the first point, the perception of alternatives. Now, in many discussions, the alternatives are set up somewhat dichotomously. Either we choose violence, or we kind of choose nonviolence. But there is kind of a third alternative, which is conceptually very important, we discuss in the book. And that's doing nothing, which is to say letting current trends continue. And that is a choice as well. It is a choice of inaction, but it is a very clear choice that you're making. I would like to highlight this. We can come back to this later. I think it's pretty important to collective decision making in general. Next, we show sanctions, negative sanctions especially, function kind of like prices. This is also pretty intuitive. There's no graphs. We don't go into any game theory. It's just a simple exposition. But the point is that sanctions only function like prices, i.e. you increase the price and therefore demand decreases up to a point. Then something happens what Gene Sharp calls political jiu-jitsu, or the paradox of violence, namely the returns to violence as violence increases, decrease as opposed to the other way around. To actually get to this point, trust is crucially important, and this is very briefly discussed. The last kind of tricky and thorny issue that we wanted to present is strategic nonviolence is a public good. A public good, unlike a private good, is non-rivalrous. And to give just a brief example for all of those who don't love microeconomics in the room, I'm sure there are very few. A non-rivalrous good, for instance, like street lighting, means that my using street lighting doesn't decrease the quantity of street lighting available to you. That's unlike, you know, a pen or this water. And secondly, public goods are non-exclusive. In other words, once you provide them, excluding non-payers from the provision becomes extremely difficult, in other words, impossible. If I don't pay taxes for my street lighting, how are you going to exclude me from walking down a well-lit street? It's very difficult. And volunteering in general confronts this problem. The problem is called the free rider problem. We don't name it as such in the book, but we do mention it, and that's why a whole part of a chapter is dedicated to how do you motivate enough people to volunteer so that you can overcome the free riding problem. Lastly, we've talked about how do you apply things that we've learned to different settings. And rather than kind of provide an infinitely long laundry list of successes and failures, we try to focus on smart practices as essentially being what was intelligent about doing or making certain choices? What were the latent opportunities, in other words, involved? For instance, in the example that we heard earlier by Steve York of the similarity between Serbia, Ukraine, and Georgia of electoral campaigns, the latent opportunity there was, hey, there's the youth which is fairly educated and it can be mobilized. Why not do it? I mean, you can mobilize them for a nonviolent movement, you can mobilize them for something else. But the latent opportunity there was, you know, the availability of youth for mobilization at relatively cheap costs. And rather than, as I said, going through an infinitely long laundry list of smart practices, we tried to give, in, you know, the 150 pages that we have, tools that would facilitate, you know, people starting out in identifying what would work in their settings. Many of these tools come from business management theory, SWOT analysis, strengths, weaknesses, opportunity, threats, the message box, how do you frame the debates about your side and about the other side, and inverse planning, which is to say, you know, planning strategically and ahead. You've heard from Sirki kind of why we did it. You have the superstructure of the book and the choices that we've made. And now we've saved the best for last.
Okay, since we're speaking about nonviolent practices over here, and they may be actually the consequence of the oppression, of the harassment, I'm not going to try to harass you too much with my wisdom and speeches. And we'll first play a short clip, which will probably give you a little bit different perspective of the non-violent struggle which happened in Serbia, and we'll actually show you that it is not about what you can see on media, electronic especially. There are some certain things which are quite developed, and we, you know, were very, very present in recent cases of the democratic changes in Eastern Europe especially, and that's why this is kind of the material or that could be used together with this book, and we'll give you basically the answers on the common question I will just name after this clip. Sean, so Ivan, would you please? Okay. Probably the spustish PowerPoint. Probably some way escape. Jedina skinny PowerPoint popustio.
Tako je. Escape.
Ajde. Evo, počet ću.
It
just goes to prove the point of necessary but not sufficient aspects of strategies and technology.
Blame the victim.
Slobo.
So I guess once we just finish the whole circle, in the meantime, I'll probably fix it, and then we can see.
All right.
But this is what I wanted to say after you would see this, and I think it's going to be exciting. My colleague spoke a lot about what's in the book, and I can tell you it's a consequence of the systemic experiences we're gathering from different countries. And the most reliable one for us is, of course, Serbia, because that was the place for us when we went to our struggle and actually picked up lots of things that we thought are very important for those who are in need of these practices. The basic question wherever you travel in different country which is oppressed country, here is the question of the activists. We are different than you were. Our situation is quite different. The other question is, or comment is, if we do something, the police is going to come out and police is going to arrest us. They're going to put us behind the bars and we can do that. Well, the book actually gives some of the answers. Why did police in certain situations react and why didn't they react in certain situations? It also gives you the idea that basically this is the knowledge that can be systematized and applied in different cultures. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. I'm not going to say that Serbia was a very successful example, because for 10 years before this, we were very, very big failures. For about 10 years from 1991 till late 1999, after the bombing, all the oppositional movements in Serbia were not efficient enough. And actually, Milosevic was using all sources of power he could find out from their problems, like mutual problems among the political parties, like the problems of their unity, problems of their common messages, and problems of their political interests, which are conflicting on their side as well. Well, this is the case. If you want to organize nonviolent action, what comes to your mind first? It is like, let's organize the march, let's organize the rally. That's 99% of the cases. We are saying that is not the truth. By using this approach in a very strategic way, by studying in a general ways your strengths and weaknesses and strengths of the adversary, there are possibility for the strategy development, which can actually be developed in a long and systematic conflict that can actually bring the change. And it does not need to be necessarily on the level of the government and the opposition. It can be very internal. So you just mentioned that Maldives are just, I would say, interesting case, which we like to point lately. In the Maldives, there is a case of our friends whom you'll see in some of this is the slide after, I believe. Yeah. This girl, her name is Jenny. She was in prison for about, I think, 2 years, and now she's under the house arrest. And she refused to be released because she was concerned about her friends who are still in the prison. And here is the problem. Her main comment about what's going on in Maldives is, well, we have a chance, an historic chance, to change the system in our country. And if we don't do that, in about 5 years, tourists are not going to come here anymore. Because radical Islamists are just growing and becoming stronger and stronger every day. They came from Pakistan and are practicing very, very hardly. And in about 5 years from now, probably, they're going to take over the government unless we do something about it. And we believe that in many cases there are similar problems. And by just coming up with a book of this kind, which is going to give suggestions and answers, and you have to understand this topic, because this is what they teach me over here in the U.S., you know, especially to Fletcher, they say, well, this is good, but where are your footnotes? Where are your references? How do I actually claim this is right and true? Well, for many things we are saying over here, we can say that, because this is the field for the academics, we believe, to focus more and to come up with the theories about it. We are sure that some things are working, some things are not. And we are practically trying to say, by just using some of these arguments and by using some of these advices, well, some of the people who are in need may see that their problems and countries are not so much different than ours, than Serbia, than Georgia, Ukraine, or some others. Well, that was basically the idea. We hope that by using these models, Serbia and other successful, as you know, and failures as well, there might be possibility for the model development, which would mean that we would be able to develop a certain model, how to evaluate a certain country's regime, the problems, the level of the oppression, and basically to build up the strategy. The issue we are saying and claiming is the nonviolent conflict, that's all nice and good, but without strategic component, it could lead you nowhere, actually. It's a waste of time, resources, and it can actually, dry down all the capabilities of the opposition to change the system or improve the certain conditions in their societies. So just by using it, we say there are tactics, and there are differences between the tactics and between the strategies, and there are differences when to adopt which one. And there are actually certain cases where it is the best not to act. And there are the ways how with small numbers there can be actually conflict, nonviolent conflict and nonviolent offense, which can overwhelm the problems of the numbers on your sides in the respect to the opponents. But because my time is up and there will be the time for the movie, I will thank you for now, and thank you for all. I'm sure that Jim
will
is supposed to say something right
yes,
now.
Yes, no.
And
I
while Jim's
you'll try to get the movie. Okay, we'll have a slight change in program, and we'll ask our commentator to come up and join us and give us some thoughts from the U.S. perspective.
I'm honored to have been asked to be here. I mean, these guys and the people who worked with them on the ground are all heroes. You know, I just got to show up to work every day and then try to support them with what they're doing. And one thing I hope everyone takes away from this is the sort of peer relationship that they're building across national boundaries. You know, people want to be able to govern themselves. They want to be able to live in a society they're proud of. That's not an American conspiracy. It's not something that should be seen as something the U.S. government's trying to impose. It's something that people who've lived through these situations can talk to one another about, and I think it's in the best traditions of America's diplomacy to try to help people carry those messages from country to country. And I hope that's something that, that people can take away from this, so that we don't lose that element of American foreign policy. It's one of the things I'm most proud to have worked on in my 12 years in government, and you know, hope to continue to support in the private sector. Now, what are a few lessons about how a movement like, say, ATPOR, or the student movements or other nonviolent movements can work with governments? And I'll try to just highlight a couple. The first is you have to learn to speak government to some extent. There are real cultural differences between any governmental institution and a nonviolent movement. So what are a few key points? The first thing is the nonviolent movement really needs to create a sense of hope. It's depressing to be faced every day by a government that seems implacable. But one of the things, say, that ATPOR did beautifully was build a sense of perspective about the weaknesses, the strategic weaknesses of the government in Serbia. And he did that through a sense of humor, through exaggerating some of the most ludicrous impulses of the regime, like a sort of conspiratorial sense of paranoia, where they were able to come out and say, "Look, I'm 15 years old. You know, I've been flying for the CIA since I was 7." I mean, and that sort of absurdity really began to create for people the sense that there was move, there was room. They seized room and created room in the society. Now, the second thing that's important then in dealing with the government is to identify a decisive moment. Typically, it's an election. It can be a response to demonstrations. It could be any sort of event. But you need a shared sense that here's a moment when we're going to bring maximum pressure to bear on this regime. And often, that won't come for years. The third thing here is identifying is sharing roles. Foreign governments will never understand what tactics work in a society. You need to let that go. No one in the U.S. government would have created the sort of tactics that were effective in Serbia. We tried and failed for 8-9 years. And now you let that go. But there are strategic things that foreign governments can do. And they're all the tools we talk about. They're tools of isolation, sanction, they're tools of engagement, tools of accountability, and others. And somehow those two need to be calibrated together in a way that's sensitive to the particular situation. Now, in that process, I'd like to applaud a group like USIP or other NGOs. They play a crucial role in encouraging this conversation between the nonviolent groups overseas and foreign governments, because the cultural gap otherwise is just too difficult. Communication difficulties impede the sort of development of a joint strategy, or at least an acceptance of one another. And to have a group like this one, it played a critical role, I know, in the Balkans, and I think it will in other places as well.
Systemic structures. So,
is to engage other domestic groups. First off, political parties. And we already heard, you know, Slobodan mentioned this. The political parties, these are the institutions that really do account for most change in a society. You need to find a way to deal with them. It's often a fallacy to believe that a broad civic movement by itself can change a society or can change policies within a society. Now, the relationship is often a tense one. And in Serbia, particularly, the nonviolent movements played a great role in shaming the political parties to become more effective. And they created then a new culture, so that by the time I had responsibility for policy, I no longer had to live with the political culture that I inherited. You know, the line, for those of you who don't know Serbia, the famous saying, "My only unity can save the Serbs." Well, for years, all of the effort for political change in Serbia was to unify the political opposition to Milosevic. When I came in, I was able to say, no, we don't care that much about unity, we care about effectiveness. And that was largely because of the change on the ground that an organization like ATPOR and others had created, that now we could talk about, let's reward the leaders who are effective and move away from those who are not, and not waste our resources on trying to bridge political differences that are irrelevant to real change. But the other groups that a nonviolent movement needs to reach out to are groups like workers or truckers. I mean, if you look at say, Steve's film of the change in Serbia, at some key moments, you start to see a lot of, you know, big, burly, middle-aged guys show up and face down the police. And these weren't students. These weren't people out there doing awkward things. These were other groups that in some situations had been bulwarks of the regime and now were being turned against it because of the outreach that the nonviolent movement had made to those folks in creating a sense that there was a decisive moment following on elections in the year 2000. The third thing is a nonviolent movement needs a strategy to address violence in two senses. And we've heard some references here from Peter and others. The state will use violence. And I got to say, I don't know that I'd be heroic enough to stand up against an authoritative government. I hope so. But that takes enormous guts. So what do you do there? Well, you look at a few things. The first is you can look to foreign governments. We can provide, foreign governments can often inhibit the use of certain types of violence in a society. You try to level the playing field a little bit so that you can move forward. But it takes an enormous sensitivity to what will trigger violence in a local situation. And that, again, is something that a nonviolent movement indigenous to a society is going to know much more about than any outsider, you know, with a theory. Now, the other point in this, though, is a successful nonviolent movement at some point depends upon a physical confrontation. There's virtually always some moment when you're walking into a parliament building at high speed, as in Serbia, or walking down a street, or bringing in demonstrators from a rural area, or trying to protect a coal mine that's threatening to go on strike, where there's a moment when the police either are or are not going to crash a barricade, or hold a barricade, or shoot. And in those moments, that you need to be prepared for dealing with that that moment. You need to be imposing enough in size, in publicity, in some way that those other guys will feel that they have to face down. You need to build bridges behind the scenes in order to make sure that the key elements, you know, in Serbia and elsewhere, there are two or three units. You need to make sure they aren't going to show up, they aren't going to come in on the wrong side. In Indonesia, the change came, I think, Ambassador knows this better than I think, the key moment in the change came when some insiders, including the security services, went and said, you know, Sarto, it's time to go. And in a 24-hour period, the dynamics changed entirely. And so you need that bridge to deal with violence. The fourth element, and I'm nearly here, is to emphasize follow-up. Once there's a dramatic change in policy or in regime, often it's difficult to sustain the momentum. And so you don't get as far along as you want. We see sliding back in Serbia, we see sliding back in Ukraine, and that's because, you know, the international community gets tired, or its allegiance shifts to be with the new government and isn't interested that much more in outside criticism or in popular movements. And you need to create a case for continuing to be engaged in the way that you were before, you won't get all your objectives. The final point I want to make is about the role of history or memory. We talk about these individual events as accidents because we don't think about everything that went before. You know, our attention shifts from Europe to the Maldives. And we say, wow, a spontaneous uprising. And we don't know what came before. In Central Europe, there were decades of confrontations between workers and civic groups and the regimes, violent in many cases. Those people create a tradition. They create the tools that then, and they give the skills for somebody like Lech Walesa or others to use at the key moment when they're able to enact the change. So from the outside, I think it's very important that as their efforts, even failed efforts, that we name the heroes of those efforts, that we don't let them be forgotten, because their memory creates a sense of possibility, reminds people about what can happen in those societies, and calls to account those who aren't living up to the standards those people set. And so my hope from this sort of movement is in particular that these guys and all that they're doing never get forgotten. I mean, Milosevic is going to be forgotten. His victims will be remembered. But I think these people deserve to be remembered for the way they stood up for their society and the way they're helping other people stand up for their own in the future. That's the sort of tradition that gives people the tools they need and the hope to go forward even when it looks dark in their societies. So I'm privileged to be here. I'm very glad for the attention.
I believe we sorted out the problem. Something to remember this presentation
about. Adaptability of strategies. So we're glad to watch a brief film and then we'll go to questions and answers. Unfortunately, technology has not cooperated. If we can take the lights back up, perhaps at some other opportunity, the fifth time when Serja and his colleagues come, we can see the film, or perhaps it will be available also on the internet. But let me now invite comments, questions, thoughts, reflections from the floor. We do have a microphone here in the front of the room, and I would ask if you use it so that everyone can hear your questions. And let me begin right away, since we do want to leave as much time as possible, and we'll bring it back to the floor after a few rounds.
Diana Negroponte, Institute of Peace. I'd like to apply your strategies and tactics to Mexico today. Your book has been read by AMLO, I believe, that is López Obrador, and his followers within the PRD, but your book has also been read by the government, so that we have a standoff between two sets of nonviolent players. Yesterday we had an institutional decision by the electoral institution declaring the victor of July's elections. AMLO believes there's fraud, the state, the government, and in fact the international community respect that there is a victim. How would you advise the PRD, that is the opposing party, the followers of López Obrador, in the street, as they now engage in their next stage to overturn the election results?
Oh, me, okay. From the point of view, first of all, Diana, you have it right. Both sides are interested in the materials and have used them for whatever purposes they've used them. But I think from the point of view of the International Center on Nonviolent Conflict, if either side came to us and said, well, what do we do tomorrow with respect to our conflict, we would tell them what we always say, which is we're not capable of providing that advice. And that's really up to you to decide about how to go forward. We just won't give specific advice in a specific context. And the reason for that is that we're not regional experts. And we often are asked in even more difficult circumstances for specific advice. And by virtue of offering it, we can put people at grave risk. So we just don't do that. We offer people the generic materials and talk about the nature of nonviolent conflict and the dynamics that lead to change in the general sense and that lead for them to decide what to do. Now, what I would say in general, and the reason we created the game is to say, look, you whatever you choose to do, you need to plan. You need to think through why you're doing what you're doing and what you hope to expect and the risks you're undertaking. And this game and the scenarios that you can build in this game for your own purposes, we invite you to go forward and to use those, but that'll be your decision.
Daniel, sir, we're early enthusiasts for Akpur.
Very early.
I wanted to follow up on what Jim called backsliding. I know you well enough to know that you're not all delighted with the shape of Serbian politics after the fall of Milosevic. Looking back at it now, are there things you might have done differently? What caused a situation in which Serbia is at best a little bit stuck?
Okay, so I'll say something about it because my friend over here was very much engaged into this after the process of democratizing Serbia after the change. But the problem of these movements is that many of them, and actually I'm not sure if all, but I think 90% of them tried to transform into the successful political parties, and it never happened. That's the first thing. Reasons why are very difficult because, first of all, the movements through their own deliberation movement and the process, they gain lots of support, they gain lots of sympathies, they gain lots of resources, human and other resources. And I think they very much mix the reasons why it didn't happen. And that's why the people who are leading them in the times of the confrontation are actually not quite clear what they're supposed to do after the change. And that probably happened to us as well. The other thing is that you should understand that from the point of somebody who was very much active inside of the movement, it is quite difficult to understand, to accept that in the end the politicians are going to take the seats again. And that maybe it can be just a minor improvement. It is improvement, but for 3 years of struggle, of sacrificing lots of people imprisoned and everything else, it is very difficult to accept that we may end up working and campaigning for the politician who we do not assume the best possible candidate at the moment. And you have to understand that math is quite exact science. It said, like, for whom you would never vote. And out of all those people we surveyed there, and we gave them opportunity to answer with about 18 answers, and we had 18 political parties, and we said, you can pick up any of those 18 political leaders. Only about 23% said we would never vote for Vojislav Koštunica. And 54% said we would never vote for Milošević. Or about 51% said we would never vote for Đinđić, who was the best and the most prominent oppositional politician who was actually managing the whole core of the oppositional parties against Milošević. And in the end, that is frustration for us. I believe that the mixture of these intentions and the aims before the elections and after was the biggest problem. And that was the failure of the Ot Board. There was no permanent, the role of the Ot Board anymore, and it does not exist. And that is the case in many other countries, in Ukraine as well. And I believe the only partly successful example that was transition in Hungary, where actually Fidesz partly or individually the leaders of Fidesz successfully transformed into the political party and actually gained the power about 15 years after.
If I can just add a comment and point three things, considering nonviolent movements, the moment of change itself, and a post-conflict period. But first of all, I know that from inside in Serbia, and we face that in Georgia and Ukraine as well, there is a tremendous gap between the expectations and the practical possibilities within country. From one hand, it's the measure of political propaganda. Of course, the opposition parties, they raise the expectations of the people so they can mobilize them to work against the non-democratic government. On another hand, it's natural for the people when the change, like, you know, Milosevic's history now, after the 12 years of war, arrestments, oppression, bombing, and now people expect that everything comes during the night. And if you look to the facts, you will see that there is no way you can economically or politically recover the country which was systematically destroyed for so many years in such a short political period. So faced with the facts, people lose enthusiasm, and that's one great point. Second great point is what Slobo just mentioned, that usually, and which was very important when Jim said that, and Peter as well, the role of nonviolent movements partly is to target the opposition and make them mechanically work together against the oppressor. I mean mechanically. These parties in Serbia, like 19 parties, I don't know the number of parties in Georgia or Ukraine, but it was pretty big. They, when you look to them, they're from the left side to the right side of the political spectrum. And they don't have a lot of similarities in the program. But the role of the movement is to put them together and say, let's work together towards change and argue afterwards. And guess what? They really start arguing the day after the revolution. You know, they really learned the lesson. And of course, the third thing is a superstructure above this. And I really felt bad when I read the a lot of American newspapers telling that Orange Revolution failed because Yanukovych is prime minister again. I would really refer to what Peter said. As a man who worked with so many groups from such many different countries, I would never take myself a freedom to politically advise and to like or dislike an individual or a party. The Orange Revolution was a success because the new government of Ukraine is elected on free and fair elections. And this is the change you brought in, that the voters and not those who count votes really decide about the elections. And if you look to the successes in Serbia, Georgia, and Ukraine, we're just focused on these three electoral based issues, you will see the same thing. And I may be very sad and uncontent with the fact that there is a possibility that the radicals, who are actually the part of the Milosevic government, gain power in Serbian society. But I would never say that it's a failure of the October the 5th, because if they come to power, it will be by the will of the people of Serbia. And this is the change which is really brought to the society. Once movement brings this change, there will never ever be somebody who will try to manipulate with the will of the people, because they learned the lesson. They will be faced with the people power.
My name is Lago, and I come from different ethnic background. I'm from Sudan, and I'm going to make a comment first, then I'm going to ask a question. So, as I listened to your speeches, you know, one thing I heard was nonviolence as a powerful tool for people to change, you know, to make changes to a government. And I very much agree with that because we have seen successful things that happen in our society through nonviolence. For example, nonviolence has been used in different societies. Martin Luther King used it here during the civil rights movement. It was also used by Gandhi in India, you know, basically against the British. And now it's used by itself to change the government. This means that nonviolence actually is a real good tool for people to make changes. But because I come from a different background, I still have different understanding of nonviolence, because I would argue that nonviolence works here in America because it was black versus white. It worked in Serbia because it was the same ethnic group versus their own government. So an issue was more important than division within the sub people. It worked in India because it was Indians or basically British. And my question is, what about in societies where multi-ethnic groups are within the same country, would nonviolent work to change the government? Because I know from Sudan, we have more than 10 ethnic groups in Sudan. And if we use nonviolent to change the government, we're going to find opposition, not within the government, but from different ethnic groups who might be supporting the government. So I was wondering if you can comment on that, and this is like a general question for all of you.
Same conclusion. Our situation is different, huh?
It will never work.
One of the things that occurs when people see the movies that Steve's created, they come to us with very hopeful, but then they spend hours and hours telling us why their movement can never work in their own country. So you get this dichotomy of hope and despair. And what we try to do is sort of look at the issues more analytically. And I'd say the question you need to ask yourself is the various groups that you're talking about that are potentially going to be in conflict, similar to the groups that Sergio mentioned, is there a basis for a common cause around a form of government that they'd all prefer versus the current status quo? Even though that they know later on they might be in considerable disagreement over a variety of issues that come from their ethnic diversity or whatever it may be. That's a question that you would have to answer. With respect to could it work, the question I would ask, I never try to answer the question, can it work, because I can't predict when these movements succeed. And I can't predict when they're going to fail. But what we try to do is say, well, are there points of pressure that you could put against an authoritarian regime or what you define as the opposition that, for whatever reason, that basically exploits differentials in loyalties and differentials in support amongst the opposition? And if there's ways to exploit those differences, and if there's ways to find unity amongst your own potential organization that consolidates many different groups, then you have chances for success. But that is the case in every movement, and that's really a question you have to ask yourself. And when you ask it, you're asking it really about the risks you take, because remember, nonviolent conflict is about civic disruption. It's about undermining a status quo in which you're always going to get a negative response from your opponent. So the question is, are these risks you're willing to take because you feel you have a good chance of success, as we defined it, unifying amongst your own group and having a vision for a society that you all agree is something worth fighting for? So I can't give you a yes or a no, but what we would try to do is help you decide for yourself.
All right.
Would you like to add something to that?
Well, I would agree. I would say it is common issue. It is just a conclusion. Our situation is different, and very often we hear that. And the only thing you can say is basically, yes, we are coming from very, very violent society as well. The last 50 years in Serbia was the longest period of peace in our history, or at least as far as we can remember. And for the first time we said, well, the Serbs are really civilized people. They could be, or they can pretend they are. And for the first time we could do something different. And for many of us it was generational issue. It was actually the fight with our parents. It was the fight between us, our generation, and our parents, who are actually standing for totally different tools.
Hi, Matthew Bolton from the London School of Economics. I actually had a question sort of looking broader at the region around Serbia, and why there has not been a similar movement to Otpor in some of the surrounding countries. For instance, why was there no similar movement against Tudjman, or for instance within the Republika Srpska in Bosnia or down in Mostar? So why was it that there was a revolution against a nationalist leader in Serbia but not elsewhere in the Balkans?
Well, I'll give a brief answer and then Suki will, I'm sure, add something. You know, to a certain extent, there was in fact a pretty popular movement against Tudjman. Mm-hmm. And that should be remembered, and not only in Croatia but in Slovakia as well. Now, you know, there's a movie about it as well, and you know, maybe their GOTV campaign wasn't as cool as the one in Serbia, and I think Stipe Mesic, who was the candidate, would probably agree with that assessment. But it was nonetheless very successful. So I'm not sure that there was a complete discontinuity. But again, I think, you know, come back to kind of the approach we tried, you know, to outline. You know, there was a latent opportunity in Serbia and in some other cases of mobilizing youth. And I think a similar opportunity did not exist in Croatia for a number of reasons. If you look at instances of draft dodging, and there's, you know, at least 5 PhD dissertations that, you know, explain that in, you know, excruciating detail in econometric models, you see very different outcomes in both Republika Srpska and Serbia on the one hand, and Croatia and Slovenia, by the way, on the other hand. So that would be my kind of, you know, answer, and I'm sure Suki would like to add something as well.
Well, it's the question how you look to this conflict, and I must disappoint you if you think that the movement in Serbia was the movement against nationalist leadership. It was not a movement against ideology. It was a movement against the men who have stolen the best years of life of one generation. And I mean, it has nothing to do with the ideology. It was not oriented like, let's say, Poland movement. You can say it was anti-communist in a way. It has a part of the ideology. But the movements movement in Serbia, unlike this movement, or you can say for Ukrainian movement, it was a way of nationalistic movement against the people who were more pro-Russian. You can look at from this ideological part. But this book and our work, we really don't try to get inside these things. Because, you know, these groups are operating for what they call the vision of tomorrow. And that's the part of the answer to your question. How do you get these groups together? You start with telling them the story on how they must develop their own vision for tomorrow, and how they can teach their people to go out and ask the people what do they see for the future of their countries. And in the Serbian case study, it has nothing to do with a nation or nationalism, because obviously the state propaganda was actually diminishing the feeling of national belonging in Serbia, because it was so, you know, used and used and used and actually misused and misused and misused. And actually it was not the big issue at all and in internal Serbian conflict.
Judy Barslow, U.S. Institute of Peace. I have two questions. I'll put them briefly to the panel. I'd like you to reflect for a moment on the really tough cases, Burma, Zimbabwe, for example, and how they differ strategically in terms of planning processes and strategies that you might use, particularly when much of the opposition, as in the Burma case, is in exile and has to organize outside the borders of the country. And secondly, I maybe put the question with respect to Serbian particular, but perhaps with respect to other questions about the existence of historical memory that may be preserved, aside from learning the gross lesson that you can't easily steal an election again in a place like Serbia. Do political parties and youth movements and other participants in these processes show evidence of a learning process where they retain the memory of the successful use of a strategy, and then they apply it in more normal political, you know, in more normal circumstances in other political contexts?
I can say briefly for Zimbabwe, that was part of my master thesis actually quite recently. The question was why didn't people actually get out and defend the election results a year ago, when it was quite obvious the elections were stolen? And I put lots of examples to what happened among the leadership of MDC, Movement for Democratic Change. The interesting thing was when one particular sentence, which was made and stated by their leader, Morgan Tsvangirai, who said, "We actually never invited our people to get out and to protest because we were afraid for their security. We were afraid that we would lose many of them. We would lose that many of them would be wounded, killed, or imprisoned." And then I tried to use the example from Serbia. When we had about 1 million people in front of the parliament on the 5th of October, when the order came from Milosevic's general to the pilot, and I don't remember actually his name, but the pilot was ordered to fly by his helicopter and to throw the tear gas bombs and shock bombs on the crowd, and he never did it. His answer to the superior was, "It's too cloudy and I can't see." And if you go even today on any web weather forecast website, you'll see in the archive that the weather in Serbia on the 5th of October in Belgrade was perfectly sunny. So the later, when the question came, "Why didn't you actually throw those cans?" he said, "Well, I was not sure if my family wouldn't be there, down there below me." And when you have like 1/8 of the total population somewhere, it is very difficult to make the difference, you know, on whom you are shooting and doing that. So that might be the part of the answer. In my opinion, I think there are some problems within the strategy of the leaders of the Zimbabwe. About Burma, I really couldn't say a lot. I would just let it somebody else to say, except from that battle, it's long-standing. And I think it is the problem when people mix what does the non-violent struggle means. When you say non-violence, there is lots of memories and instant thoughts about human rights and about defensive. How do we defend our human rights? Well, non-violent struggle, it's also about offensive. And there is one sentence said by Bob Helvis who said, "If you want to win, you have to take the offense." And that's about it. And with all these movements who took their strategic approach, who actually developed their long-term strategies, it was about the sets of actions which were quite offensive. Actually, they were forcing their opponents to make the strategies how to defend by actually also picking up the battles which you can win. I believe you can achieve a lot. A certain example from Burma and as well from Zimbabwe, like a typical nonviolent action over there, would be stay away. Like, we stay at our homes, we don't go to work, and that's what we do. Well, to do that, you need enormous logistical support. How do you inform your people without access to the media, when to get out, what to do, etc.? And I think there were sets of mistakes they did in the long term. As well as I'm aware, I think that Burmese immigration in some surrounding countries are actually just coming again together and building up some new structure as well. Well, we'll see.
I will jump back to Zimbabwe case study because we worked a lot on it. Slobo did a part of his thesis on it, and I had an opportunity to work with, I don't know, 5 different groups from Zimbabwe until now. And some of them were really brave people and being arrested many times. And it was not a problem only of the bravery of the leadership of the ruling party. It was the problem when Peter speaks about a strategic nonviolent conflict, he usually said that he starts with a how many Peter things important for the success, and you finished with only 3. And one of which is, of course, the planning. And the problem with MDC in Zimbabwe was the fact that they were aware that they can easily win the elections, meaning in numbers, but they were not prepared for the day after. And if you look to the Steve York's movie about the Serbia, you will see Zoran Đinđić telling that we knew that we were won, we knew that Milosevic is not going to accept this victory, and we were ready for the next step. And NBC could count on this, because it happened in Zimbabwe twice. Actually, twice the opposition won the election, Mugabe said no, they didn't want the elections, and then what happened? And that's the problem in recognizing the momentum. It's very important to recognize this momentum and use it. And if you don't do it, the whole movement can collapse. And the problem in Zim nowadays is the fact that a lot of very proactive groups in Zimbabwean society actually you can see it as well through internet, are demonstrating day by day, using nonviolent tactics, networking among the NGOs, and they're all coming out from MDC. They don't have the connection with the party. Actually, the party is partly recognized as the obstacle to the change coming from these groups. Why? Because they didn't use the momentum.
I would just add one more stuff, that there is often huge mistake that makes a problems in those society. And mistake is about the political parties and civil groups and civil societies. Mm. And there is often the understanding of certain civil society groups that they should actually take the political lead as well, the political power, mm-hmm. in a meaning like to run for the seats. And I believe that is often very problem because those groups are very, difference between the NGOs and political parties is that NGOs are self-appointed organizations. You know, six of us, we can divide our roles and positions inside of our small NGO and go around the world and present and be all the times presidents, vice presidents of the board, main board, committees, etc. And basically we are self-appointed and we call ourselves like that. And we joke very often when we say that some NGOs we have, but we have also FGOs. And FGOs we call the future governmental organizations. We say there are certain organizations which are just calling themselves NGOs because they're waiting for the time of the period of time when they can actually take the political lead. And no matter how, that was the question of partly of Daniel Severin, no matter how the opposition or the political, alternative political structures are bad, that is the evolution process. That in Serbia, we knew that we are going to have problems because even our opposition, they're a product of the communist school, right? They're educating themselves inside of communist society, and that's about it. It's a small, small progress, but that's how it works.
I'm often asked, what is the best leadership structure for a nonviolent movement? And like so many other things, there's no formula because it comes in all shapes and sizes. In the case of India, you had an iconic figure who could unite the Muslims and the Hindus and basically had a strategic vision that really culminated in the Salt March, which was the greatest civic disruption in the history of mankind to that point. But if you take that, but he was able to create an organization that had some depth to it and had some redundancy to it. If you look what's happened in Burma now, we have another iconic figure, Aung San Suu Kyi, but I don't think she has a depth of her organization. So when she's shut down, the movement to a certain extent is shut down. You have other cases where the people are not only iconic, they're not even known. For example, in the case of the Danish resistance, it was evidently 13 or 14 people who were not known, but when they spoke through cultural symbols and they were listened to authoritatively and their commands were acted upon. And you have all sorts of variants, but the key to leadership is to be able to mobilize and to keep movement going, to basically never find yourself in a situation where you're shut down from the next tactic and the next form of pressure. And that is all a function of cultural specificity and the nature of the threat that comes back to you. So the problem in Burma might very well be we have an iconic figure with no redundancy. And when that redundancy occurs, then there'll be more effectiveness.
Judy asked a second question that I didn't want to forget, and it is the question of the memory of struggle and the extent to which succeeding generations or people who are just 10 years younger than you guys, the odd poor people, know what you did and may be in a position to use these ideas. Look at our own country. You know, the Montgomery bus boycott was in 1956, I think, 54, 55, 50. This is 50 years ago. The Nashville sit-in movement was in 1960. Those of us who have children who are in their teens or 20s don't know about these stories, and we find showing you films, which include the Nashville sit-in movement as one of our stories, teenagers and those in their 20s today are amazed that things like that happen in this country. I don't know what the answer to this is. I have had a couple of conversations with South Africans who were part of the anti-apartheid struggle when it was really at its peak in the middle and late 80s, who have bought or asked for, and depending on the case, copies of our film about that particular episode, which they're now going into classrooms, inviting themselves. You know, no one is asking them to do this, but they've essentially taken it on themselves to do what they can as individuals to keep the memory of that time and of the heroism and of the ingenuity alive in other generations. But in any case, I think there's a real danger that these things do get forgotten. And as a footnote, slightly sour, some of the tactics that were used in the anti-apartheid struggle, and I'm now thinking about rent strikes, boycotts, are being used against the current government because of the lack of progress in helping in raising the standard of living in the townships. And there are groups in townships who are now using some of the same tactics, whether appropriately or not, I don't know. And that's a question that has to be decided internally. But to that degree, no, they've not been forgotten in a few cases.
We are closing in on the end of our session, and I know that Jim O'Brien has to leave early, so I just before we go on to the next round of questions, I wanted to see, one, if there are questions specifically for Jim, if you could then ask it first, and also, Jim, if you would like to say something before leaving us, then please feel free to take the floor after the question. We welcome that, and thank you on behalf of all of us for joining us. Please, we'll go to the next question, which is directed to Jim, I believe.
Ray Jennings, Woodrow Wilson Center. And it was a great cue because I wanted to take off on something you said, James, about this calibration between external assistance and the internal movements. And, I mean, there's some estimates put the amount of funding into Serbia at over $100 million from 1990 to October 2000. And two-thirds of that perhaps being spent 98, 99, 2000. If that's the case, that's a lot of resources. And if it's not calibrated right, then, of course, there's a lot of waste. If it's calibrated correctly, then that's a tremendous leverage. So I wondered if, Jim, maybe you could talk a little bit more about this necessity for calibration and then your advice in Serbia and other places where these resources are going, how we get this linkage between internal movements and external resources, right?
Great question.
It's a great question. I enjoy your work, too, so I'm not surprised to hear a great question. I will say for the record, and those numbers are very inflated. I mean, they include things that were in people's budget requests and never appropriated in humanitarian assistance, so it wasn't on a scale like that. But there were substantial resources. On a per capita basis, Serbia received much more than many other places. I guess I think there are a couple roles from the outside. Maybe the two most important come before you actually spend any money in a country, and that is pay attention and spotlight problems. And I think we're just now starting to do that effectively in Burma. We've talked about it. We've used U.S. bilateral sanctions, but for the first time, you're getting multilateral attention to the situation in Burma. And I think that's a hopeful sign from effective organizations. There was attention aplenty in the Balkans by the late 90s, but I think that's a key role that the outsiders have to play. And, you know, when I've talked to friends of mine, say we're very active in the Czech resistance in the mid to late 80s, they say that the most important thing for them wasn't any money or material support they got, it was that when they got arrested, they knew they weren't alone. You know, they knew that someone outside was going to talk about them. And that's a thing we can do from the outside. So when you talk about, you know, the Cuban dissidents, you know, Madeleine Albright used to keep the names of the most recently arrested dissidents on her desk. And when she talked to anybody who was involved in Cuba policy, she said, I want these, at the time, the four key leaders, I want them to be a focal point of what you talk about. And I think that's something that you can't ignore. You know, putting a face and a name is critical. And then blaming where it's matters helps to lay the groundwork for activities to take place. The second thing is you need to limit the government's range of options. And you can do that a lot of tools. We tend to think about the sticks, sanctions and isolation and blaming. You know, as well, sometimes you can limit a government's range of activities by more engagement, by tying assistance to particular things. In Serbia, we started an effort. It never quite came to fruition. thankfully, because of October 5th, but where we were trying to deliver humanitarian assistance, but take it out of government-controlled channels and put it into channels that had NGO networks actually delivering the aid. And it was a way of building those networks, but also making sure that they got political benefit from being the ones to distribute it. I know there's been talk about doing something similar in Burma. And so those are things that can be done from the outside with even before the assistance arrives, and then to shape the nature of some assistance. Now, in terms of how to engage, I think the every place has different lessons, and here are a couple of the ones from Serbia, and I realize I'll forget some important ones. One of them is stay out of the way. You know, there was a period in which the U.S. government seemed to feel that we were electing the opposition, and so whatever opposition leader was closest to us, you know, was going to be the one that would you know, carry the day. And that's, you know, it's a tough balancing act. On the one hand, you want to say these are serious, substantive people who are capable of representing this country on the international stage, and that's an important message. At the same time, you don't want to say these are our people and you got to be for them and not for someone else. And so there's a dance about conferring some legitimacy and respect, but then also pulling away. And we pulled away very dramatically in 2000 in the run-up, and that allowed the focus to be, as Serge said, this was on Milosevic. This was just about Milosevic. It wasn't about who was running against him or an ideology. It was about that one man, and we got out of the way. A second element is pay attention to what you can do. We began to put enormous emphasis on technical support, and in particular on technical support for the days after the election. And some of it was get out the vote and other things, which actually there were very successful campaigns in Croatia and elsewhere on those areas. The situation changed largely because Tudjman died and the HDZ started to kind of collapse. So you didn't have the dramatic moment, but you did have these kind of grassroots campaigns, and we learned a tremendous amount about working with these kinds of organizations in that region from there and from the Kosovo Albanians and others, heading into 99-2000. But to focus particularly on the time afterward, and to say, okay, here's the assistance we can give you, or NGOs will give you on organizing, demonstrating, and running a political campaign, but now let's have a conversation of what happens once the people who are counting the votes start to come out with fraudulent results. And that was a real focal point for our efforts in the last month, and I think that's a place governments play, a unique role. So it's a partial answer, but then finally, it's communication. Now, I think we changed... I certainly changed tactics and tactical support, you know, nine times from you know, midsummer till early fall, and it was all because the situation on the ground seemed to be adjusting. And I think that kind of open channel of communication is, you know, can't replace it can't be replaced by any grand plan or, you know, vision that's blessed at a high level in the government. So with that, that's the last I have to say, and I think it's a great discussion.
Other comments on the calibration?
There is one example, which I think it's a very, very good one. Before that, how to achieve the unified message by the movement? How do you achieve that message from activists of your movement is the same? And how to do that is basically to estimate what kind of questions could come up from the journalists, from the police, from the friends, environment. The first question to estimate is, where do you get your money from? That is the first one which is coming to any movement leaders or movement activists in any movement. And as the example, I'm going to say, the Zubr was the biggest and the strongest movement in Belarus. It was the movement who actually conducted lots of non-violent activities before the elections in 2002. And it was disbanded and destroyed the very first time they introduced the salary among their activists, because they had plenty of resources, plenty of money, I would say. And it was very easy for the opponents to infiltrate and actually to start a discussion, why am I getting so little when I'm working so much, and you are working, you know, almost doing nothing and getting so little. So I believe that the right management in that case is, as it was for us, because it was also the problem in our heads. You know, we were people coming from the country which was bombed by U.S. Do we actually accept the U.S. offer and take get some help? Or do we take U.S. money? Well, we resolved it, I believe, in an efficient way by saying, well, this is what you can teach us, what we are missing. And we are missing actually the knowledge how to run the campaigns. we never did it. In our political life, that never actually worked, and we never saw it. So could you please get us somebody who's very much knowledgeable about political campaigns who can teach us how to do that? And all your resources and money spend on him coming and teach us how to do that. And if that sort of offense is present inside of the movement toward anybody, I believe there is no problem. The problem starts, one in the case in Zimbabwe is as well, when international factors are having their own programs, they do not cooperate among themselves. They have their own certain counterparts inside of the country, and they give them the resources and the support individually without coordinating that with the broader issues. And that is the problem. I believe much broader than just by regular regime saying you are foreign mercenaries because you're paid by some foreign countries. And by the way, $100 million sounds to me unbelievable. You know, my mother would say, son, please, why didn't you give some of that to me when you were so rich at the time? I believe that has no grounds.
The $100 million you specified, I'm sorry, I forgot your name, is over a 10-year period.
Right, and from and not just from U.S. sources, by the way. That's right. From Soros. And
I want to be really clear. Within that, it's important to make a distinction between money which may have come in for the purpose or at the time of or during an election campaign or an election year and at another time before there was an election campaign going on, and make a big plug, which I have heard in my travels in a number of countries. I want to make a huge plug for the kind of quiet, slow, patient, capacity-building civil society support involving things like professionalization of militaries, training for journalists in how to do investigative reporting, courses and workshops in the rule of law for judges and for lawyers, all of which has gone on in many countries, and which is for no, I mean, obviously, money is very rarely given with no larger strategic purpose, but as a general thing, those kinds of programs are perceived in countries like Serbia and Ukraine, where I've been a lot lately, as helpful. It even goes to opposition political parties, teaching them how to do polling and so forth, I mean, or to the regime, to the parties within the government at the time. That's perceived as very helpful, useful stuff that doesn't actually have an axe to grind, but it all pays off when that decisive moment, such an election, comes.
Jim wants to say
it's just an enormous effect, and I very, very much appreciate it.
And I want to add a couple postscripts just because I'll have given you an incomplete picture and we'll feel bad about that. I mean, I think there are a few important points. One is the outside support does come in the form of training and more so than cash. You know, it's not, there's not a lot of, you know, here's $50, vote our way, you know, Chicago ward healing kind of work. The now, and that helps to get around some of the political problems. But the more important point is, it's not something that it's not a bilateral program. One of the things I was most proud of, the international effort, the multilateral effort, say in Serbia and elsewhere, there was enormous effort to make sure that there were great divisions. You know, the Scandinavians did great work with some municipalities. The British had great media programs. And you can go around the list, and the neighbors in particular were fabulous. I mean, you had the Slovaks, the Croatians, the Hungarians, and others, all of whom provided an awful lot of very sensitive political support and also logistical support so people could come in and come out. That's missing in a lot of these hard cases. You know, the situations of the neighbors in Sudan, Burma, Zimbabwe, you don't have either the bases or the sort of cultural recent experiences that are so useful, and you can't do it from, you know, down on 23rd Street in Washington, D.C. It's got to come from the neighborhood.
Well,
I think you could classify external assistance in a few ways, and Jim sort of covered them. One is the training, sharing of information and best practices. That's also consistent with what goes on in democracy promotion, which lays, as Steve correctly states, lays the base for this activity. The other is providing the ability for people to communicate independently of the people they're in opposition to, because that allows them to move freely and allows them to plan, that allows them to protect themselves. And also the creation of an effect, strike funds, the way the ones that were helped, for example, by the trade unions, U.S.-based trade unions in Poland, is that people need to have the right, if they're threatened with their livelihood by basically taking a stand against the government, they need to have the right to feel that they're not going to be destitute. Now, the good news about all of this is that they're not very capital-intensive activities. And I would argue that, for the most part, they should be conducted through NGOs and they should be conducted on a multilateral basis. But there are also certain activities that only governments can do. For example, one that's proven to be very effective recently, evidently, is the ability for the U.S. government to shut down the use of certain accounts in Macau by the North Koreans, who are basically using it for money laundering. And the reason that they can do that is because nobody wants to be shut out of the U.S. financial system. Because once you're shut out of that, you're shut out of the world. And so there's an extraordinary amount of U.S.-based power that can be applied there. But for the most part, much of this activity is basically a request from assistance and the assistance that I just described. The last point I'd like to make is that we have to be very careful here not to be fooled. One of the backlashes of the colored revolutions is the globalization of the backlash of the colored revolutions, and you hear the Chinese or the Zimbabweans getting together, or the or Chavez saying no more colored revolutions, and they're trying to basically harmonize and share best practices about how to counter these revolutions. One of the things you hear in the rhetoric of these leaders is that this kind of assistance is basically an infringement on their sovereignty, and that's just a completely bogus notion, and that is something I think that we generally have to deal with. For example, Putin really argued that democracy promotion is just another form of civilizing acts that basically going back to the rhetoric of the British and the French and the during the colonial period. It's complete utter nonsense, but today people are sort of receptive to that idea, and it really needs to be countered. So we do need, I think, to create a set of international norms about what kind of, when people request assistance from inside, what kind of assistance is permissible, which cannot be embargoed by the people of government or the people who are basically the manufacturers of the oppression that people want assistance against. And I think there needs to be an international dialogue about that and a set of common precepts that transcend whether this is about American hegemony, which usually is also another easy battering, place to basically criticize the colored revolutions. But the fact is that this assistance is legitimately requested, legitimately provided, and the international community has to say that the authority, just like the authoritarian that Kofi Annan made this clear that, and this is increasingly true in international law, that populations have the right to democratic government, they have the right to not have their assistance requests embargoed by the people who are preventing them from having democratic government. And a general consensus about that will go a long way in terms of directing and making easier this kind of assistance and making it more effective.
My apologies to all of us, including our panel. You'll have a moment to respond. We unfortunately have run out of time, and so my apologies to the remaining questioners. But I do encourage you to come up after the end of the formal program if you have questions for the panelists or comments, to please share them with the panelists. I would like to take a moment and just ask each of our panelists if they have some final concluding thoughts, and then thank all of you for your contribution, your attention, for your support, and I encourage you to visit all of the websites, including Canvas's website, which is canvasopedia.org, York Zimmerman Productions at yorkzim.com, and of course the Center on Nonviolent Conflict and nonviolentconflict.org. And last but not least, our own at usip.org to hopefully help sort through many more of these questions and create further food for thought. So let me just begin with Andre, who's busily writing notes, and see if you have final concluding thoughts, very brief.
Okay. I'll be as brief as historians can be. So I guess, there was a great question about memory. I would like to say that, it's a choice that society makes. I teach at Cal, which is, which has a great tradition of student activism. And every class I teach, I have to remind the incoming class that there's a great tradition of student activism. But once you've taught it, they actually take some very useful lessons from it. So I think memory is our responsibility, and it's intergenerational. That's all. There were a couple of comments on backsliding, and I think that's a very, from democratic to non-democratic changes. I think that's a very important evaluative criteria. But I would also like to highlight one that I think should be highlighted every time we talk about strategic nonviolence. Hundreds of thousands of kids, youth, could easily be trained in violence. Instead, they're being trained in nonviolence, which gives them skills, research, in management, in organization, i.e. the skills that are necessary, if not sufficient, for a modern, well-functioning society and one that's less likely to backslide. I think that's tremendously important. You know, it would be a great empirical study, and I don't think one has been published, to kind of see what are, you know, the time-lagged effects of money spent in nonviolent training and monies and resources spent in all sorts of, you know, nonviolent training. I am sure that the net social benefit of the former outstrips exponentially the latter, and that's even including, you know, benefits from technology development and, you know, other externalities not, you know, taken care of. So those would be the two things, memory and backsliding.
Nothing much to say, but just to reinforce your conclusions that if you just visit our website, you'll find many of the materials. I'm very sorry about the movie. I'll make sure personally that it's going to be, you know, for that to be downloadable from the website. And I hope you're going to have fun with reading this book. The basic point is that this stuff we were speaking about is knowledge which can be adaptable, transferable, and if done in the right way, I think it can help in many ways, in many places, for different purposes. So much.
Well, thank you all for spending 2 hours with us. Thanking Forward for spending some time investigating in our work. Once again, the purpose of Center for Applied Nonviolent Action and Strategies is to improve the knowledge transfer process. That includes the workshops, the books, the different tools, and with, of course, telling once again how grateful I am to the United States Institute for Peace for supporting this thing, and hope that we will cooperate in the future. You are all invited in helping us with this work.
Thank you, Sir.
I think the greatest things that happen on the subject of nonviolent conflict are the ones that excite me the most, the ones that we have absolutely nothing to do with. And I remember this summer, Sergio told me about the book. I didn't even know it was in the works. And when I read it, I was really happy. I think it's a terrific product, and I think there's a tremendous amount to learn from it, and I'm very grateful you guys did it. The other one is Steve, who basically has done all the great movies on the subject, and is about to finish one on Ukraine, which I think you'll find is the most extraordinary one he's done so far.
We I assume I can. I just wanted to point out something about the nature of where do we get ideas from, and who do we trust? I think this is a fairly universal feeling that I want to express. It has to do. Maybe the easiest way to illustrate is if you own a car and it needs work done, are you going to take it to the 18-year-old next door or somebody you don't know who probably isn't trained to work on that car, or find somebody who actually has some training but most of all some experience? And without taking away, I've had this book in my hand now for about a month and I've been through it in a fairly detailed way. And without taking away from its content, which is terrific, it's nicely presented in a way that is more accessible than most other printed material on this subject. I must say that one of the great virtues of this book is that it comes from people who have done the things that they're writing about. The credibility that attaches to someone who's been there and who has done it, and not only that, has succeeded, I think is enormously valuable in making this book attractive and making it the kind of thing that other people who may be engaged in struggle will want to use, and it's more likely that they will pick it up because of who wrote it. I just think that point cannot be overemphasized. I want to make sure it was on the table. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Steve. That was a wonderful note on which to end this event. Thank you all. And we hope we'll see you at our next set of events, and keep tuned for new and exciting adventures. Thank you.